Welcome to the session on eating disorders, dysregulated eating, and athletes. I'm Nancy Clark, and I'm just going to sit down here. Let me just start again. So this is take two. Welcome to the session on eating disorders, dysregulated eating, and athletes, also known as dieting gone awry. Many athletes are physically fit, but the question is, how many of them are nutritionally sound? When you look at all those runners, you just think, oh, they're so fit and healthy and they can run a marathon. But how many of them are indeed healthy, or has dieting gone awry? How common are eating disorders among athletes? The frequency of eating disorders is higher among athletes than non-athletes. The study suggests that 20 to 22% of athletes have eating disorders as compared to 3 to 9% of the general population. Weight-sensitive sports have an especially high prevalence of eating disorders. 24% of endurance athletes, a quarter of them. Almost a third of athletes in sports with weight categories like lightweight rowing or wrestling. 42% of aesthetic athletes, skaters, ballerinas, dancers. So this is a big problem and very often goes unacknowledged. When we look at dysregulated eating in high schools, this is a survey of 240 female high school athletes from a variety of sports. Half of them reported menstrual irregularity, which is a red flag for under-eating. 42% had two or more risk factors related to the female athlete triad. The female athlete triad, as you know, is the combination of eating disorder, stress fracture, and amenorrhea. And it has been expanded beyond that to include both males and females now. But if we just look at this survey, the risk factors were amenorrhea, past stress fracture. Once you've had one, you're more likely to get another. Self-reported not eating enough, so under-eating. Being underweight, as measured by a BMI of less than 5% for their age. Feeling pressure to be a certain weight. And wanting to lose, you know, at least 10 pounds despite being a healthy weight. So this was prevalent among these high school athletes. When we go to the college level, here's a survey of 425 female collegiate athletes across the United States. And on average, these varsity athletes wanted to lose 5 pounds. 43% reported that they felt terrified of becoming overweight. You can imagine what that does to their intake of carbohydrates. If they're terrified of becoming overweight, how well are they fueled? 22% reported being extremely preoccupied with food and weight. 31% reported menstrual irregularity, again, a sign of under-eating. A third had had a bone injury, such as a stress fracture or broken bone. Only 3% reported having anorexia as a diagnosis, but 15% at least were at risk. And only 2% reported having a diagnosis of bulimia, but at least 32% were at risk. Now, you can give surveys to these athletes, and if anything, these numbers are underreported, because who's going to say, oh yeah, I binge and purge at least, you know, twice a day? They aren't going to do that. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. Dysregulated eating, disordered eating, eating disorders, whatever you want to call it, impacts even world-class athletes. There's a study of runners and race walkers at the very top level. A third of them didn't have their menstrual period, of the women, and 40% of the male athletes had low testosterone levels, which is a sign that the men were also under-eating or under-fueled. Compared to those with normal reproductive function, both amenorrheic females and the men with the low testosterone lost more training days due to bone injuries, such as stress fractures, and they had a 4.5 times higher incidence of bone injuries. So clearly, underfueling impacts bones and hormones that regulate bone health. Today, the female athlete triad has sort of expanded to include men, and it's referred to as relative energy deficiency in sport. The physical signs of undereating, of having an energy deficit, could be a low body temperature. For example, when I'm in my office and I have a new client, or even if they're an old client, I always shake their hand. And if it's a cold hand, that puts up a red flag. Oh, they're probably under eating. So cold hands, cold feet, low body temperature. If they have their heart rate measured, it's low, fewer than 60 beats a minute for women, 50 beats a minute for men. And people say, oh, that's just because I'm a fit athlete. It's like, no, you might be under fueling. There might not be enough energy for your heart to be pumping the way that it should. And if they were, you were to measure their heart rate, there'd be a 30 beat per minute difference in heart rate between lying down and standing up. So this is called POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. But if the heart doesn't have enough fuel to pump right, then to beat right, then that can be picked up by the physician. The cause of these changes in physical capacity is due to low energy availability, LEA, low energy availability. And what that is a mismatch between the energy intake, the food that you eat, and the energy expended in exercise, the amount of calories that you burn, leaving inadequate energy to support optimal health and performance. You can't be a very good athlete if you're injured with a stress fracture. And this energy deficit can be intentional, as in someone with anorexia or someone who's dieting, or it can be unintentional, which sometimes happen when people are eating clean and they're just filling up on lots of high fiber foods and wholesome grains, and they just aren't hungry. They just don't know that they're not getting enough. They knock off the potato chips and the cookies and the ice cream, but they don't replace it with enough calories of quality foods. So like I say, it can be intentional, it can be unintentional. But relative energy deficiency in sport, red S, impairs many body systems. It's not just that they're not having their menstrual period, but it affects bone health, endocrines, metabolism, blood, more likely to be anemic, impacts the immune system, growth, development, can change the brain, have psychological effects, impairs the cardiovascular system, the GI tract. So really all the systems in the body are impacted by not having enough energy to function normally. The negative impacts of red S can be reduced endurance, training response, reduced muscle strength, lower glycogen stores, inability to concentrate, poor judgment, lack of coordination, but a higher risk of injury and very time, more irritable, moody, and depression is a big problem. So this isn't just about amenorrhea or low testosterone. It's about the whole body that gets impacted by not having enough fuel. So what? So why should we care? Well, if almost 20% of male athletes and up to almost half of female athletes are struggling with food, we do want to care. The medical complications certainly can impact athletes' short and long-term health. You know, stress fracture today could be osteoporosis in the near future. Injuries that keep them from playing, so they're unable to help the team have a winning season. Plus, you know, being underfueled is associated with tremendous mental anguish. People with anorexia have a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression. Anorexia has the highest mortality rate of all mental illnesses. And between 10 to 20% of people with anorexia die a premature death. Maybe not from malnutrition, but very often from suicide because they are just so depressed. suicide is 57 times more likely in people with anorexia than their peers. So we can make a really big difference in somebody's life. The quest for thinness certainly can hurt performance, and the myth just perpetuates that thinner is better. But here's a study that shows that thinner does not improve performance. It's this 12-week study with elite female swimmers, and they sort of divided the group, those that were eating adequately, about 2,500 calories a day, versus those that were restricting and eating only about 1,800 calories a day. What's interesting is the restrictors had a higher percent body fat, which is maybe why they were restricting to lose weight. But their resting metabolic rate was reduced, and they were having irregular menstrual periods compared to the adequate eaters that were menstruating regularly. They ate about 700 fewer calories a day than their peers who were eating adequately. And yet, they didn't lose any weight during the 12-week training session. You know, how could that be? Because their body was hibernating. They were 10% slower in the 400-meter race at the end of the season. So their efforts to be leaner just hurt their performance. So this was, I was really curious about why they didn't lose weight. So I called up the person who did the research and asked them if they, what their parents looked like. And the researcher said that yes, most of their parents were on the heftier side. And my interpretation of this is that these swimmers were trying to be too thin given their genetics. So you can change your body a little bit, but nature sort of takes over and you can't change it as much as you want to all of the time. So when I'm working with athletes with disordered eating, eating disorders, dysfunctional eating, whatever you want to call it, the goal is to be for my clients to be fit, which they are, to be healthy, regular menstrual periods, warm hands, to be at peace with food and at peace with their body. There is no number on the scale that is attached to the goal, but to be fit, healthy, and at peace. As I said, the myth just perpetuates that the lightest athlete is the best athlete. And there are pictures here of Molly Seidel, who's an Olympian, and she suffered from an eating disorder, and then she recovered and came back to be a champion. And so she's gone public with her study, but you can just see how in that top picture, how she's so cachectic, so wasted. And in the bottom picture, she's the champ. So the truth is the best athlete is not the lightest athlete. It's the athlete who's genetically gifted, well-trained, well-fueled, and well-rested. The truth is that lean athletes come in varied sizes and shapes. And people say to me, oh, I want to look like a runner. What does a runner look like? You know, what does a dog look like? Well, in the dog kingdom, there are St. Bernards, there are greyhounds, there's Labradors, there's poodles, there's beagles, there's chihuahuas. What does a dog look like? What does a runner look like? And the St. Bernard, is a St. Bernard fat? No, a St. Bernard is a St. Bernard. And if you took that St. Bernard and dieted down, it would not be a greyhound. It would be a miserable St. Bernard. And I see this happening all the time among athletes. And these athletes, as you can see, they come in different sizes and shapes. And it's not right or wrong or good or bad, but their talent comes from the genetic gifts that they have. So often my clients talk about, I feel fat. And what I remind them is that fat's not a feeling. I mean, do you feel blue eyes? Do you feel blonde hair? Do you feel freckles? You don't feel fat, but you're likely feeling imperfect or less perfect. And if you put on a little skimpy ballet outfit, it's really easy to feel imperfect or less perfect. Maybe you're feeling inadequate or less adequate. If you're the freshman on the team, on the varsity team, it's really easy to feel inadequate or less adequate. Maybe you're feeling out of control, anxious. I mean, there are all sorts of things you can be feeling, but it's not fat. I'm too fat. Too fat for whom? Too fat for what? Where did you get this message that something is wrong with your body? And these messages can easily come from social media. And we know that people that spend time on social media, that it just totally destroys their body image and their self-confidence. But maybe the message came from a very loving parent who at a very tender age said something like, "You know, honey, that dress looks really good, but if you just lose a few pounds," and what this little girl hears is, "I'm not good enough. I'm only lovable if I'm thinner." No weight is ever perfect enough to do the enormous job of creating happiness. And this quote is from an excellent book. It's called the Don't Diet, Live It Workbook, which I often recommend to my clients. It's one of many excellent books at www.edcatalog.com. They have a whole bookshelf of excellent books for people to read. But no weight is ever perfect enough to do the enormous job of creating happiness. And there is one woman who tells a story how she weighed 124 and she wasn't happy. "Well, if I just get down to 99, get below 100, then I'll be happy." No, maybe you'll be more perfect. But she got down to 99, she was miserable. And then, as often happens, people with anorexia start binge eating. She started binging. Her weight went up to like 145-ish. And of course, she was distraught and miserable. Then she went through counseling and her weight returned to her 124. And she was happy. Why couldn't she have been happy at 124 in the first place? Because it has nothing to do with weight. Happiness has nothing to do with weight. So when I work with my clients, I do a lot of work on body image and remind them that to compare is to despair. And ask them, you know, if they're on a team, do you spend a lot of time comparing yourself to others? And inevitably, they say yes. They do a lot of body checking, look a lot in mirrors. And what I suggest that they do is practice living on their fantasy island, where they and their bodies are good enough the way they are. In fact, their bodies are probably excellent the way they are. But many people can't wrap their brain around having an excellent body. But maybe it is good enough. And living on that fantasy island, if they stay on that island, they'll be much happier. Because if they go off the island and start comparing themselves, "Oh, she's thinner than I am. Oh, she's smarter than I am. Oh, she's better than I am. Oh, she's more popular than I am. Or hair's nicer than mine is." To compare is to despair. I mean, do you ever end up on top of the heap when you start comparing yourself? Not very often. So just live on this island where you're good enough the way you are. And athletes just continue to deny the fact that being lighter might not enhance performance. And oh, the power to weight ratio is what cyclists talk about. And runners say, "Oh, I don't want to lug this, you know, fat up the hill or what this weight up the hill." But being lighter might not enhance performance. Here's a case study of a sophomore who is a collegiate runner. And she comes to me saying, "You know, I used to be a really good runner both in high school and as a freshman in college. But now as a sophomore, I've gotten slower. I thought I could run faster if I lost weight. So I cut back on my food. And I've ended up gaining weight. My times keep getting worse and worse." And so often when people try to lose weight, they cut back too much and then they binge and they gain weight and they're totally frustrated. So she came to me totally frustrated. And her concern was, "I'm getting slower." So her translation was, "I must be too fat. If I'm lighter, I'll be faster." Well, the actual problem was she was anemic. And the solution was iron supplements. It had nothing to do with weight. But it's just sort of sad that most runners think that when they're slower, that they're too fat, or else they need to train harder, and maybe they're already overtraining, and that's why they're slower. Here's another case study of a national champion. You know, that's pretty good. And she was a senior in college. She comes to me talking about how I'm too fat. I'm like, too fat for what? To win a national championship? But she felt that she was too fat. She started doing double workouts. She was running more than the coach had recommended. She would do up to 45, 80 miles a week. She cut back on her food. She was trying to eat 1,200 calories. She had no idea how many calories she deserved to eat, which is about 2,600. So she had cut her food intake in more than half. And she'd diet, and then she'd binge two or three times a week at night. She'd get scared, and then she'd purge. And she came to me feeling as though she was addicted to food. I'm just addicted to food, you know, and she couldn't control her eating anymore. Well, I asked her what a typical day was, which was what I do with my clients, ask them what they typically do in terms of eating and exercise. So in the morning, she'd get up, she'd run for 30 minutes, come back and have some yogurt and fruit as she rushed off to her class. She had class during lunchtime, so that was very convenient that she had no time for lunch, so she just took some fruit and pretzels. Then she would practice, and here she is running on empty. And by the time that dinner came around, she was starving. So she would binge eat and sometimes eat way too much, get scared, and then she would purge. Her boyfriend was on her, you know, you gotta go see Nancy. So she came to see me, and I gave her a more realistic food plan and reminded her that she really didn't need to lose weight, but let's just get stable. And she came back a week later and she said, I feel great. I had a good week. Eating was so easy. So she really didn't have an eating disorder. She just had gotten too hungry and had dieted too hard. And she was able to easily turn that around. So it's wonderful when clients come and boom, they can just make changes. But that doesn't happen very often. She just needed nutrition education. She needed to respect the power of hunger. So when I counsel my clients, I talk a lot about hunger and how it's physiological. And as I mentioned before in the previous session, you know, the analogy is, can you breathe normally after having held your breath for too long? No. You hyperventilate. Can you eat normally after having eaten too little food for too long? No. Just physiologically, you will not only eat but overeat if you have gotten too hungry. And this is the physiology of hunger. 30% of dieters who seek help with weight loss are binge eaters. They end up binge eating. And for some people, binge eating serves a purpose in that it just resolves the hunger, that they've just been dieting too hard, they're too hungry, and they eat, and that resolves it. But for other people, binge eating might be more emotionally based. It cheers them up for that moment, or it can distract them from the sadness or the pain that they might be feeling. It numbs them out. If you're feeling stressed, you know, to smother your feelings with hot fudge sundae, does a great job of distracting you, numbing you out. It can be a great way to procrastinate. Oh, I think I'm going to have some buttered popcorn because I don't really feel like doing my homework right now. And it can be a convenient alternative to addressing one's fears or concerns. So the question is, what are you doing with your feelings? And many people starve them. Some people stuff them. But how about we feel our feelings? And feelings come and go. They last for about 20 minutes. They come in waves. And if people know that they can just sit through those 20 minutes and feel their feelings, write in a journal, That's a much better way to deal with them than to smother them with hot fudge sauce or to starve them and numb themselves out. So when working with binge eaters, the first advice is to stop dieting. Let's just get stable. Let's just eat appropriately on a timeline, food bucket every 4 hours, and eat enough. Practice eating intuitively. Listen to your body. How do you know when you should start eating? How do you know when to stop eating? Do you listen to your body's and your body's cues? I encourage my clients to be compassionate and gentle on themselves. If they blow it, they were probably just trying to give themselves a hug, that they were having a hard day. So to be gentle on themselves, be as kind to themselves as they would be to their best friend. And really to pay attention to the emotional aspects of binging. You know, what's really going on? What purpose is this serving? And have them experiment with new ways to self-soothe without food. And we might make a list of, you know, 4 or 5 ways that they can deal with their emotions and take care of themselves without eating. Maybe they can watch a mindless movie, you know, go for a gentle walk around the block, talk to a friend, you know, write in their journal. There are many ways, more effective ways, to deal with feelings than it is to smother them. If you're, a trainer or a professional who's wants to screen for eating disorders, there's something called the SCOF questionnaire. And it's just a few simple questions. Do you make yourself sick because you feel uncomfortably full? Do you worry you've lost control over how much you eat? Have you recently lost over 14 pounds within 3 months? Do you believe you're fat when others say you're too thin? Would you say that food dominates your life? And if somebody answers yes to 2 or more of these questions, that's highly suggestive of an eating disorder, but this is not a diagnostic tool. But if they answer yes, you want to make sure that you send them to the proper person, to a counselor, to their doctor, to a sports dietitian, and make sure that they get the care, the proper care that they're needing. Now, a lot of people don't have outright eating disorders, but certainly they have subclinical eating disorders. And that's the majority of the people that I see in my private practice. They have specific characteristics. These food-obsessed people undereat by about 500 calories a day, more or less. They eat a repetitive diet, very little variety, strictly low fat. You know, I ask them, how do you eat compared to your friends? And they go, oh, I eat like a bird compared to my friends. I ask them, what do they typically eat in a day? And they say, oh, that's easy. I eat the same thing every day. And they do. They eat the same thing every day. They categorize food as being either good or bad. And they feel very guilty and angry at themselves if they break their food rules. So I remember talking to one client who had a new boyfriend who knew that she was really into healthy eating. For her birthday, he made her a carrot cake and she had to eat some. And it was just so sad to listen to herself beat herself up that she had a piece of carrot cake for her birthday. She broke her food rule. So the question that I ask my clients to sort of help figure out how serious a problem is ask, what percentage of your time do you spend thinking about food? And when they say, oh, way too much, it dominates my life, or I'm embarrassed to say, or 99%, then I know that this is a big issue. And with time and with healing, what percentage of your time do you spend thinking about food? And they'll say, maybe, I think about food when I'm hungry before lunch. And I remember getting an email from a client of mine who went through an eating disorder program, and she was fueling herself properly. And she wrote, sent me an email saying, so this is what it feels like to be perky and not think about food all the time. And that's the power of being adequately fed. So my clients, and likely your clients too, present with these concerns. Oh, my diet's horrible. I eat way too many sweets. I've got a wicked sweet tooth. Oh, I have a very good diet. I'm very careful about what I eat. I eat only healthy foods. I'm always cold. Even the summertime, I wear a sweater. I feel tired all the time. And I had one client who started eating more, and she goes, you know what? I didn't need a nap last week. She was just flabbergasted that by eating more, she didn't need an afternoon nap. Why aren't I pencil thin by now? For all the exercise I do, I should be pencil thin. So we brainstorm reasons. When I'm working with frustrated dieters who haven't lost weight, I said, let's see how many reasons we can come up with for maybe why you haven't lost weight. And we take turns. Do you want to start? You want me to start? Well, maybe they've gained muscle and have lost body fat, so the scale hasn't changed. Are your clothes looser? Maybe they have an increased appetite from all the exercise that they're doing. The more you exercise, the hungrier you get. Maybe they reward themselves with food for having done that killer workout. Maybe they overeat sports drinks, gels, recovery foods. I had one Ironman triathlete, couldn't figure out why he was gaining weight for all the exercise he was doing. Well, he did a phenomenal job of fueling up, fueling during, refueling with all these sports foods, and then he'd go and eat a big meal. And he just didn't register with him that there were a lot of calories in those gels and sports drinks and recovery drinks. Maybe they're under eating satisfying meals, and then they graze on good food and end up eating too many snacks. Maybe they're sedentary athletes, and that's why they haven't lost weight. They do their workout, but then they're sedentary for the other 23 hours in the day. Maybe they're chronically dehydrated and they want something, so they eat. Oh, let me have some grapes. Or let me have an orange. Let me have an apple. Maybe they're just thirsty. Maybe they just want water because all that fruit, it has calories in it. Yes, it's healthy, but it still has calories. Maybe they're so tired from over-exercising and they just are needing a quick energy fix from sugar, a sugar fix. Maybe they're trying to lose essential fat that is very tough to lose. Maybe they don't have any more fat to lose. Perhaps they're leaner than they realize. And they just pinch themselves and what they pinch is empty fat cells, but they think that it's flab. So many athletes forget that they're supposed to have some body fat. Even men have essential body fat, 3 to 5% of their weight should be essential fat. Women, 11 to 13% body fat. So women naturally have more fat than men do, not just in breast tissue, but hips, thighs, inner thigh, abdomen. And that is just a storehouse of calories for pregnancy and breastfeeding. I used to measure body fat a lot. I've sort of gotten away from it and focus more on genetics because I really think that there's a genetic component to weight that doesn't necessarily get measured by calipers or measuring body fatness. So the focus of my nutrition counseling really is on health. It's not on weight. You just have to trust that if you eat appropriately and exercise appropriately, your body gravitates to an appropriate weight. But my job is really to educate the client about the physiology of hunger and how they will never win the war against hunger. And how when you get too hungry, it's very easy to binge eat and feel out of control with eating. We talk about stress and stress management, and how stress can really take its toll on eating. Some people stop eating, other people overeat. When people are stressed, very often they don't sleep well. So we talk about the importance of sleep, not just in terms of managing one's appetite, but also in terms of performance. We look at carbohydrates. Are they trying to stay away from those fattening carbs? Are they eating enough to support their exercise program? We look at protein, particularly if they're vegetarian, and are they getting enough protein to support their muscles? Look at fat as an important part of a sports diet, helps to knock down inflammation. And for some of my clients, we talk about calories. Most of them are already counting calories, but if working with someone who's a little bit obsessive compulsive, it can be a slippery slope. So that's a judgment call. We look at realistic weight goals. You know, how do you look compared to others in your genetic family? If you were to create this family reunion and bring together everybody, are you leaner than they are, same as they are, heavier than they are? And work at body acceptance. They don't have to like their body, but they can at least tolerate their body and accept it and be grateful for it, for all the wonderful things that it does for them. So again, the goals are to be fit, healthy, and at peace. When I talk with my clients, I ask them a lot of questions. We look at motivational interviewing. You know, tell me about your history with diets. Oh, you mean like when I was in fourth grade, I went to Weight Watchers with my mom? Yeah, tell me about that. Oh, it sounds like you are very frustrated. Yeah, for all the exercise I do, I should be pencil thin by now. What do you mean by being bad? You know, eating a piece of birthday cake is being bad? I can't even imagine how hungry you must feel. You know, I had one client, she'd run 10 miles and only then did she deserve to eat a baked potato for her meal. I can't imagine how hungry she must feel. What would happen if you didn't exercise today? Go off the wall, I'd get fat. You'd think the world would end if some people didn't exercise one day. I keep the counseling very client-centered, and I take a detailed weight history and food intake. I ask them what's a typical day of eating, and then I do a more thorough intake looking at all that they're eating and ask lots of questions. How much of an issue is food for you? You know, food for some issue, it's a huge issue. It just dominates their thoughts. How much of an issue is weight for you? For some people, I gotta lose this weight. For others, like, well, it'd be really nice if I could lose a few pounds, but it's like, hey, life goes on if I don't. How long have these been issues? Well, when I was in high school, you know, the summer before I went off to college, I lost a lot of weight. What led up to your calling me? Oh, I had a really bad weekend. I just binged all weekend. When are your hungry times of the day? Oh, I'm hungry all the time. What do you do when you're hungry? Well, wait until lunchtime, wait until the next meal time, eat by the clock. How do you know when to start eating? How do you know when to stop eating? Well, I start eating when it's noon and I stop when the sandwich is done. And they stop eating because they think they should, not because their body is content. What do you wish was different about your eating? Oh, I wish I could just eat normally, that I could just go to a restaurant and order off the menu without all these special requests, dressing on the side, you know, sugar substitute, grilled dry. What do you think I'm going to tell you? Most people think I'm going to tell them to eat more fruits and vegetables. It's like, no, I'm going to tell you to eat more ice cream and cookies, perhaps. What are you afraid I'm going to tell you? That I have to gain weight? What dietary changes would you like to make? I'd just like to be able to go out with my friends and sit around and have a drink and laugh and have fun and eat nachos. What benefits will come from changing your diet? Well, I'll get my parents off my back, or my boyfriend off my back, or my coach off my back. What concerns you the most about changing? And very often they're concerned about losing an identity, that they're going to get fat and lose the identity of being like the thinnest person on the team or the tiniest person. What's your long-term vision for change? Just being able to fit in and eat what they're eating, what everybody else is eating, to go to a family Thanksgiving and just eat apple pie. What are you willing to start working on today? And maybe they can just do one little baby step, because all these different baby steps add up. And maybe they could start having a half a banana before they go for a 8-mile run. It's amazing how much energy people need when they're recovering from anorexia. I mean, they might need 23, 27 calories per pound of body weight. So a 100-pound person might need 2,300, 2,700 calories. That's a lot of food if you've been living on 800 calories or less. So when I work with my clients that have been under eating and need to bump up their energy intake, again, it's the timeline, it's the food buckets, a breakfast snack bucket, lunch bucket, second lunch bucket, and a dinner snack bucket, but evenly fueling throughout the day. And we gradually increase their intake. And if a person has been counting calories to see how little that they can eat, I tell them how much their body deserves and what it actually requires. So for someone that needs 2,300, 2,700 calories, ideally, they're eating 500, 600 calories for breakfast, and we sketch out what that might look like. Lunch could be 600, 700. Second lunch, perhaps, you know, a little bit less. Dinner or dinner snack. And they leave my office with a food plan, and they know that in each food bucket, ideally, they have some grain to fuel their muscle, some protein to build and repair their muscle, some fruit vegetables for vitamins and minerals, some calcium-rich food, preferably dairy or soy, for calcium for their bones, and some sort of healthy fat. And I have them make up their plan and then ask them if they were to do one thing, what's the first thing that they might do? If they were to do two things, what's the second thing that they might do? But we just take baby steps, working towards their goal. And inevitably, this little eating disorder that sits on their shoulders saying, oh, you can't eat that. You can't eat that much. And I have them reframe those thoughts. You're just having a thought that you can't eat that food, that you can't eat peanut butter, or that you can't eat that much. You're just having a thought. And talk about, you know, what is your eating disordered voice saying right now? And we talk about how they have their intelligent voice and their eating disordered voice, and they often get in wars. So what's your eating disordered voicing? Oh, if you eat that, if you eat peanut butter, you're going to like get fat, and that'll make you slow. You don't want that to happen. Don't believe her. Yeah. What's your healthy voice saying? My healthy voice is saying that I'm miserable and what I'm doing now isn't really making me healthy. I have all these niggling injuries. Can your healthy voice calm down that eating disordered voice? And that's the job of the healthy voice. Just calm down. Nancy says this isn't the get fat diet. This is the get healthier diet, to get out of hibernation diet, to feel better, to feel warmer, to perform better diet. And just calm down. And this is a process, as you can imagine. I give my clients SMART goals, or should I say, I ask them for what their goals are, but the goals need to be specific, measurable, action-based, realistic, and on a timeline. For example, I will add yogurt to breakfast 3 days this week. You know, the client might say, oh, I'll have yogurt for breakfast every day. But no. Let's do something that is realistic. Let's do 3 days this week. I'll grocery shop on Monday night so I have food to eat. I'll exercise no more than 60 minutes, 5 days a week. Specific, measurable, action-based, realistic, and on a timeline. And again, have them identify their goals. So what 3 goals do you have for this week? And they tell me their goals, and then come back a week or 2 weeks or whenever later and see how they did. But I remind them that coming back is not contingent on having made any changes, because sometimes the eating disorder voice is really overpowering and they can't do something as simple as eat a yogurt for breakfast. I have some case studies here. So this is a case study of a 28-year-old woman who comes to me because she wants to get pregnant. She says, I've been trying to get pregnant. My husband and I really want to start a family. I've been amenorrheic for 7 months. The doctor says my body's in starvation mode. She thinks I'm not eating enough. So she sent me here to see you. This woman is 5'5", currently weighs 145, 150. Her goal weight, she wants to weigh less, like 135, 140 pounds. Even, you know, the rule of thumb, someone who's 5'5 weighs like around 125 pounds, more or less. So seemingly, you know, you'd think that she could lose weight. But when I asked her how she looked compared to others in her genetic family, she said, oh, I'm leaner than they are. So she was, there's a possibility that she was lean for her genetics. When she was a junior in high school, she weighed 185 pounds. She whittled herself down to 135 pounds with a lot of exercise and a lot of food restriction. When she came to see me, she was exercising an hour and a half, 2 hours a day, doing high intensity workouts, doing a lot of jump rope. I asked her what a typical day looked like in terms of eating and exercise. She'd get up at 5. Should do a couple of hours of her high intensity workouts, should grab a Kind bar for breakfast on her way to work. 10 o'clock, she had some grapes. She pushed off her lunch as long as she could till 1 o'clock, where she'd have some hummus, carrots, and fruits and veggies. By 4 o'clock, she was starving and she gave herself 2 clementines. She'd have some grapes when she got home from work. And then she'd have her dinner, 2 eggs, brown rice, and spinach, and just a little bit of ice cream afterwards. She reported trying to eat less than 1,200 calories. She deserved to eat at least 2,400 calories. So no wonder she wasn't menstruating. She was, you know, very much in energy deficit. So she needed education. She needed to know how many calories her body required to support life, exercise, and to be healthy, to have regular menstrual periods. We created sample meals with appropriate carbohydrates to fuel the muscles, protein to build and repair the muscles, fat to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins and to help her knock down inflammation. We talked about variety, moderation, not eating the same food every single day. And also talked about how there's no such thing as a bad food or even a good food. An apple is a good food. A diet of all apples is a very bad diet. So moderation. We looked at sports nutrition. She was doing a lot of exercise. We talked about fueling up, refueling afterwards. A Kind bar, 200 calories when she burned off 400, 600 calories, that is not adequate refueling. So she's either fueling up or she's refueling. We talked about intuitive eating and how her body could regulate a proper intake for a proper weight. And she just had to trust that if she ate appropriately and exercised appropriately, that her body would gravitate to an appropriate weight for her genetics. The goal was to eat when she was hungry, stop when she was content. I give my clients helpful mantras and affirmations. So with this woman, I reminded her that she needed to have a healthy body if she was going to create a healthy baby. That her body would be happier now if she was eating more. that her workouts would be better, that she didn't need to choose a perfect diet to have a good diet or even an excellent diet, that she needed to be more flexible, and she could always go back to her old ways if she needed to. So I saw her 2 weeks later, after we came up with her initial food plan. She comes in, she says, I'm eating more, I do feel a lot better. She'd cut back on her exercise. She was exercising only 1 hour a day, and she was able to take one rest day a week. She said, I feel so much better, and I am in such a better mood. And her husband really noticed the difference. And we worked more on having her bump up her energy intake and to think about food as fuel. She comes back 6 weeks later and she complains, oh, I'm eating way too much at night. I feel stuffed. I'm feeling out of control. I need to be able to control my portions. And what's interesting, even though she felt as though her portions were out of control, her weight was stable. But she still needed more calories. She was eating only 1,700, 1,800 calories, and that was not enough. So worked with her more and tried to do more with intuitive eating and how she wasn't, if she was eating too much at night, that's probably because she was under eating during the day. So we worked more at eating according to the biorhythms, the chrononutrition, and set up another appointment. And unfortunately, she canceled her next appointment. She was just overwhelmed. And this is just a perfect example of how probably food is not the problem. So what is the real problem? If it's not food, what about life? And eating disorders are a psychological diagnosis. She was trying to change her food without getting psychological help, without the help of a counselor. And the truth is that life is the problem. Food is the symptom. And eating disorders are a psychological diagnosis. Common life problems are dysfunctions within their family. Very often it's alcohol abuse within the family or food abuse. It could be sexual abuse, poor communication within their family members, depression. Sometimes perfectionism is the problem, and the recipe for anorexia seems to be a person who's physically beautiful, a perfectionist, and has low self-esteem, doesn't feel good about themselves. You know, if only I'm thinner, if only I eat more perfectly, then I'll be happier. Separation issues are often the problem. I see a lot of juniors in high school, seniors in high school, freshmen in college, seniors in college, moms with kids going off to college. But separation is very, very painful. Like, what are you doing with your feelings? Oh, I think I'll go train for a marathon and run a lot of miles and eat less and starve my feelings, or maybe I'll just smother them. People with eating disorders commonly have the following personality traits. They have a great desire for control. They strive for perfection. And they're compulsive. And these traits can make them very good athletes. You know, an athlete needs to be in control of their weight and have the perfect training program, the perfect body, compulsive. But it can become problematic when they control their food too much. When they have the perfect diet, like I say, a diet, an apple is a perfect food, a diet of all apples is a very imperfect diet. These traits are common to adult children of alcoholics, of whom one third reportedly become bulimic. Food abuse, exercise abuse, it's all the same stuff. And so a question that I ask my clients is, has alcohol ever been a problem for you or for anyone in your genetic family? And more often than not, they'll say, oh, my grandpa was an alcoholic, or oh, my mom's a recovering alcoholic. She hasn't drunk for a long time though. But it's just sort of a red flag. So we talk about these personality traits that they can use to help them recover or to go down that slippery slope. So what can we do to prevent eating disorders? And prevention is certainly far preferable than trying to resolve them. And this is an interesting study that was done in Norway with athletes who attended these elite sports high schools. So in Norway, the top athletes go off to these high schools where they're boarding schools. They live with others in the dorm, and you can imagine how much comparing and despairing they do. And eating disorders can be a huge problem. So they were trying to figure out ways that they could prevent eating disorders from starting in the first place. And what they found is that if they boosted the athlete's self-esteem and belief in themselves, then they felt better about themselves and they didn't have to be thinner to feel better or in more control. And the way that they did this was to have each student think of three things a day that they did that they felt good about that had nothing to do with them as an athlete. Oh, I helped my friend solve a math problem. Oh, I helped somebody else who was injured by getting them some food because they couldn't go to the store. Oh, I made my roommate laugh. So they just it just broadened the way that they thought about themselves. It expanded their vision. And when I work with my clients, they come in saying, oh, I'm a runner. It's like, no, you're a person who runs, but you're also a friend, a fun person to be with, somebody that can make your sister laugh. And just the focus, take the focus off of, I'm a runner as my identity, as I'm a person who runs. And it's very important that parents get that same languaging down. But it's amazing how this just simple thing was able to prevent eating disorders from occurring. So I'll wrap up with a little story about Ellie. Ellie came to me when she was about 67 years old and how she had lived her life since she was 13 years old. She lived it by the following food rules: that eating is a fall from grace. Eating nothing is ideal. She believed that her body was different from everybody else's. It stored almost all food as fat. She didn't eat food she liked because there was a very high danger of binging. She didn't eat foods if she didn't know how many calories were in them or how much fat was in them. Now, mind you, she had four children that saw her endure these rules for her their whole life. She prevented hunger by drinking coffee to fill herself up. And she ate as little fat, bread, or starches as possible. So pretty restrictive, huh? So after years of treatment, she now has some new rules. And she realizes that hunger is a normal and positive aspect of being alive. I mean, if you're hungry, that means your body's alive. That food is a beautiful and pleasurable aspect of her life. And she sends me, wonderful cards at Thanksgiving, just saying how much she's now able to enjoy the Thanksgiving meal with her family. She appreciates her body for what it can do, not for its size. And she enjoys pleasurable exercise as to take care of herself, not as a punishment for having eaten. But so often she spent her whole life eating and then punishing herself and going out for runs. But now it's pleasurable exercise. And her favorite exercise is yoga because it reinforces self-care. But what a wonderful transformation from food as being the fattening enemy to food as being fuel. And this is the part of my job that gives me the greatest satisfaction of working with people who struggle with food. So if you as trainers are able to partner with dietitians just to help your clients overcome their food fears and their food struggles, you too can make a really big difference in their life. If you're looking for more information, my sports nutrition guidebook has a very strong section on how to overcome eating disorders, disordered eating, and looking at dieting gone awry, body image. So it's a handy resource. There are also excellent resources at edcatalog.com or the National Eating Disorders Association, NEDA, and SCAN, the Sports and Cardiovascular Dietary Practice Group of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, also has a referral network and information that might be of help to you. So with that, I wish you best wishes for helping clients who are struggling with food.